Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, the Texas state legislature indulged themselves in one of their favorite fetishes, making it hard for women to use their reproductive rights. This time out, the women are chattel set are targeting minors and making it harder for them to obtain a judicial bypass. What is that? We shall explain. Meanwhile, in Washington, we have a classic story of the haves and the have-nots. Some members of Congress, apparently alarmed that food stamp recipients can just walk into a grocery store and buy whatever is there, is proposing to change this. Meanwhile, another group of Congress critters are proposing that they all get a raise because it's just too hard to live on a six-figure salary while you're waiting to cash in on your connections after retirement. As usual, it's pay raises for some, tiny American flags for others. Finally, we pick up where we left off last week with part two of our conversation about Seymour Hersh's alternative telling of the Osama bin Laden raid and its aftermath in the media and politics. I'm Jason Linkins, here today with Huffington Post reporters Akbar Ahmed, Arthur Delaney, Sam Lockman, and Ali Watkins. And here's what happened first.
Hey.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, guys.
It's Jason. Arthur.
It's Arthur. Hi.
This is Sam.
Yeah, okay. That's really well done, you guys. I like that. This is great. So welcome to So That Happened. We're chomping at the bit to get started today. We got dog imitations. We're talking about pork rinds. It's going to be an interesting podcast today. I'm Jason Linkins, editor of Eat the Press. Joining me today is a veteran of this podcast.
Arthur Delaney.
He writes about economic issues.
I basically write about food stamps these days.
Yeah, food stamps. We're going to talk a little bit about that today. We're also joined by someone making her debut or premiere. Do we decide it's premiere?
Debut.
I like debut more.
All right. On So That Happened.
Sam Lockman.
Our dual citizen reporter.
Yes.
Sam is from Vancouver originally.
Invading.
Yes, and I'm fascinated.
Like Ted Cruz.
Yes.
That's right.
Though I have not renounced my citizenship.
Smart.
So far.
Sam is part of the burgeoning Canadian Reconquista movement. pretty soon we'll all be eating poutine, and there will be our football fields will be 110 yards long.
Right.
And we will have rouges, right, in football.
What's a rouge?
It's like a two-point play.
Oh, we are about to have that.
We are about to have that in football. See?
Oh, wow. So we're already working our magic.
Exactly.
The two-point play.
Exactly. Well, welcome, you guys. How have you guys been this week?
I'm good. I'm going to Denver after work, so.
I know about you going to Denver.
I'm excited for that.
Smoke weed.
A certain executive in this office asked if I was going on a marijuana tour this weekend.
And are you?
I'd like to decline to comment about
that. Okay, that's fine.
Don't eat too much. It really is a risk. People made fun of Maureen Dowd, but she was right.
Right.
If you eat too much, you'll think you've thrown your life in the toilet.
Yes. Slices.
It's like, buy a nice bottle of whiskey, but don't drink the whole thing in an hour.
Right.
Yeah, those are the things you do. Air is very thin up there, so, I mean, it's good to supplement it with something.
Unless you're splitting between many different people.
Do that.
Oh, yeah, that's good. That's good.
Right.
Puff, puff, pass.
Like your parents.
Yeah.
Oh, no. No, now, not like that.
Now we're implicating a lot of things. But again, Canadians.
Canadians, man.
They're amazing. The one thing I'll say about Denver, I had a lovely time in Denver. I was there for the '08 convention. I had Rocky Mountain oysters, and I thought they were delicious. But their airport is terrifying.
is it?
It's really terrifying.
It was, like, it terrifying because of the state you were in? You were just overwhelmed by Democrats everywhere?
Although, funnily enough, I was on the same flight as Maureen Dowd.
Oh, wow.
No, she was at the luggage thing with me.
That's amazing.
And I was just...
You didn't warn her. You didn't see just, into the future.
I was, like, looking at her. I was like, I wonder if she's staring at this luggage conveyor and thinking, I could use this in my column for the next 40 columns.
Right.
Right?
Like the Terminator... It's just going the scanners.
She's like a
column worthy or not every target.
She's like a hackery sponge. You know, if someone like says a cliche in the course, she's like, "Oh, that's mine now, son. That's mine now." My metaphor. No, but the airport is filled. Okay, a lot of people have like these kind of like eerie feelings about the Denver airport.
Uh-huh.
It's like part and parcel with a lot of weird Illuminati mythology, and there are a bunch of very weird pieces of artwork all over the airport. But leaving that aside, what's terrifying about the Denver airport is that when you step outside, there's a gigantic white horse,
right,
with glowing red eyes.
Right, the red eyes. Evil horse. It's like the bunny
Donnie Darko.
Donnie Darko.
Yes.
But it's a horse. That's what it looks like.
Yes, it
sounds
is.
Like a war horse.
It is a war, famine, pestilence, and death horse out there in Denver. And like the glowing red eyes are just amazing because it's just like, this is great, but how can we make it terrifying?
Right.
You know? So we're going to talk a little bit about something that I guess a lot of people find terrifying today.
Nice Texas transition.
You're not used to my transitions.
No, I like it.
They're always terrible.
Speaking of red eyes. And,
yes, exactly. Yeah, I did a really terrible one last week that I'll never live down. I am at my most Maureen Dowd when I'm doing transitions between segments.
Right.
Believe me. I will latch on to any piece of dumbness that I can get. So, okay. Samantha, Sam... How do you prefer to be? You prefer...
I'm a Sam, but there are two other Sams in this office. So.
And there's soon to be there's a Samantha.
Yeah, but you're not a byline Sam. Samantha, right?
Samantha in the byline.
I like...
Sam Lachman on Twitter.
I like confusion, so everyone's Sam to me.
Okay.
Okay, so Sam, you wrote this week about what's going on in Texas with the most recent round of I guess what people call trap laws, targeted restrictions against abortion providers.
No, this one isn't actually anything to do with clinics.
I'm sorry, you're right.
They already trapped all the
clinics. They trapped the clinics.
How many clinics are left in Texas?
So
now it's targeted restrictions against women. Law.
Yeah. And minors, specifically.
Traum laws.
Wow. That's a new thing. We should make that happen. There are like less than half as many clinics in Texas as there were before these trap laws went into effect. But there's like an injunction against that. And so the Federal Circuit of Court of Appeals heard arguments a few months ago about those laws against clinics. And that court could rule against the clinics and shut a whole bunch down. And then it's probably going to go to the Supreme Court.
Okay, so there are still places in Texas where a woman can get an abortion.
In like the major cities. But a whole like, you know, Austin or...
And those particular laws, if I recall correctly, they mandated that abortion clinics had to be up to the same sort of standards of code as an ambulatory surgical center.
Exactly, which like mandates like the width of the hallways and how many bathrooms you have to have and what kind of like air ventilation systems, like nothing to do with actually anything medical. So
right.
Very expensive upgrades for a lot of clinics that weren't able to manage those and would shut down if this law that they passed actually goes into effect. But it's all held up in litigation right now.
Okay, so tell us about the new law that has been proposed and is moving through the Texas legislature.
Yeah, the Texas House passed this new law, and the Senate is any day now, could be even today or tomorrow, is going to pass this law that deals with what's called judicial bypass. So judicial bypass is where there's a minor, someone under the age of 18, who wants to get an abortion, but maybe they're living in foster care or they have abusive parents or they're worried that getting the notarized consent that Texas requires would put their lives in danger. So Texas requires – some states say you just have to notify your parents. Texas says you have to get notarized consent from your parents. So if a minor says, well, I can't do that, then they can go to petition a judge and say, hey, will you allow me to have an abortion? So Texas is trying to make that whole process more difficult in a whole bunch of different ways.
Notarized consent. Can we have more information about what that is? Do you have to like get your parents to go with you to a notary public?
Yeah. Seriously.
Or do notary publics make house calls?
Some do.
Right.
My wife's a notary public.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
That could be useful to me at some point. Yep.
She would happily notarize this, but unless we don't live in Texas.
Okay, I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, not at all. The particularly, I think, kind of most insidious part of this legislation that they've proposed to make the whole process for minors to get an abortion more difficult is that they also said that the state will presume that everyone seeking an abortion is a minor unless that person shows a valid form of government identification. So they took the rationale behind their voter ID laws and applied it to the procedure.
Wait.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
The law assumes everyone seeking an abortion from now on is a minor?
So you could have someone who clearly is like in their 30s walk into a clinic and they have to show a form of identification. And if they don't have a driver's license or whatever, they wouldn't be able to get the procedure.
That is nuts.
Yeah.
That so would so a school ID suffice for that?
That's the question, Arthur. So I have been bugging the sponsor in the Texas State Senate, who's sponsoring this legislation, passed the House, now it's in the Senate, to say, what does a valid form of government identification mean? Because that's all the law says. It doesn't spell out what specific types. Because, as we know, when Texas passed their very strict voter identification law, which is one of the strictest in the nation that had severe impacts upon people, basically a lot of different people trying to vote last year.
People who, you know, just by coincidence might Democratic.
Right. Exactly. Voters. Yeah. Lower income people.
Yeah. It might be poor.
They said for elections that you can use a gun permit, for instance, but not a government issued student ID if you go to the University of Texas at Austin or whatever.
That makes sense because, right. Like, clearly, if you're doing book learning, yeah, you probably should not be voting.
Well, the idea is.
Or getting an abortion.
Yeah. Right. If you're ready to shoot some shit, yeah, yeah. Texas.
So you might. So it sounds like it's quite possible that this would be the same standard for the abortion ID.
Right. We still don't know the standard.
Aren't you allowed to vote for a gun in Texas? Can't you be like, my gun would be a great...
there was an Onion article.
I think my gun should run Abilene. Yeah. El Paso City Council is like 6 dudes and 15 guns. that's insane.
Yeah. So we don't know what specific types of identification will be kosher. We're waiting to find out.
It sounds like they don't know either.
They don't know. He's still, like, they told me, I kept on bugging him. They said, we're going to get back to you on that because he might offer some sort of amendment or whatever before the Senate votes on it. But for now, that seems like a pretty big impact. Not just, you're already making it more difficult for minors to get the judicial impasse and bypass. And you're also saying for anyone who's seeking the procedure that you also have to have this form of identification. And specifically for women, it's difficult sometimes to have government ID because, like, maybe you lost your birth certificate and you might need that to get whatever type of driver's license you want to get or whatever. So it's not just a process that might take a few days. And to me, the more troubling part of this is that, let's say you have someone who is bumping up against the number of weeks that a clinic will do the procedure, and then you have to go get a form of ID. Maybe you pass the number of weeks that you're allowed to get that procedure in Texas. You might even have to, like, leave the state and go to New Mexico where there's a clinic that does it later. So they're pushing people to do it later.
They will probably criminalize that.
Right.
At some
leaving
point
the state. Leaving the state.
Right.
So you might even be forcing people to delay. It's like safer to do it earlier, right? So it, in a lot of different ways, it doesn't seem to have anything to do with safety. And, like, what are we afraid of? Is that
by never defining a form of ID, it opens up the door to moving the goalposts at the provider level too.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So, and then in terms of the judicial bypass, the thing that I wanted to bring up is that it used to be that if you're a minor and you have a lawyer or whatever, you could petition a judge in any county in Texas to allow you to have an abortion. Because the idea was, like, let's say you live in a county with 5 people, you know, your parents or whoever you're afraid of asking for an abortion might find out. So you could go to another county and ask a judge in another county to protect your privacy. And now they're saying you also have to do it in the county where you reside.
This is part of a wave of abortion proposals,
yes,
to restrict the procedure that has been going on since President Obama took office, in some ways triggered by the Affordable Care Act, focusing attention on medical procedures.
Yeah, and specifically in 2010 when a lot of Republicans took over state legislatures across the country. That was sort of part
of the Tea Party backlash.
Yeah, exactly. So 2010 was the start of it. I think the most restrictions, like, ever were in 2011 and 2012. So things are sort of calming down now because they have to come up with creative new restrictions. So there's – and what you'll see is states copying each other. So Texas is the first one to do this, like, mandatory ID thing. So I'm sure we'll see that in other states. Or now new states – like, they, you come up with all these different things. Like, some states are saying –
you've got to have solid gold girdies.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Or they're telling doctors to tell patients that the medication abortion, the pill you can take up to 9 weeks, is reversible. Which is crazy. You're supposed, like, doctors in two states, I think it's Arizona and Oklahoma. I might be wrong about that. But two states, you have to tell them that the procedure, if you take the pill, could be reversible.
Which is a lie.
It's not based on anything. It's like, so you get all these different types of new creative restrictions that aren't just targeted at shutting down clinics or aren't just targeted at moving it from you can get it until 24 weeks or whatever the Roe standard is to earlier.
It's targeted at lying it to people.
Yeah, now, yeah. So, yeah.
And Wendy Davis, no longer in the legislature?
No. So we'll see what kind of – I mean, they also, in Texas, they changed the number of votes you need to approve legislation in the Texas State Senate, or the number to have a filibuster or whatever. So Democrats are, like, really have basically no power in the Texas State Senate. So this is guaranteed to pass. It'll be interesting to see if the governor signs
it. They should get guns.
Add guns to their caucus.
Yeah, exactly.
Gun representatives.
So moving on, I've been feeling we're going to have a little bit of, like, the haves and the have-nots briefly. I've been feeling the food stamps issue lately.
Oh, wow.
That's why I called you, Arthur.
Thank you.
To talk about food stamps. What's new in the world of food stamps?
Well, food stamps actually is...
Because the last time we talked, there was sort of some good news.
Yeah, I don't remember any good news about food stamps. Well, the good news may have been, you know, fewer people are on food stamps.
Right. Well, I think you said that, like, the Congress had taken up the issue and they had, like, not been talking about it in the stark terms that people on food stamps should be stigmatized.
Republican leadership has tried to refrain from having any focusing on food stamps in a bomb throwing way.
Right. Okay.
Their committee chairmen are like that as well. But I think it's this issue is really hot just beneath that level. I think it's like abortion actually in the states. It's constantly, there's been a wave of legislation targeting food stamps this year, but it's part of a bigger wave that's been going on since 2010.
Mm-hmm.
With this year, the hot new thing is restricting what people on food stamps can buy with the benefits.
Yeah, I noticed that. And I've obviously seen the news about the laws that you can't go on a cruise if you're on food stamps. And I mean, I'm not particularly moved by that. But what baffles me is that these restrictions that keep people from eating seafood.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes fish is the healthiest stuff in the store.
That is baffling to people because... You have to be sort of a food stamp reporter, basically, to notice this pattern of complaining that people on food stamps are eating crab legs all the time.
Crab legs? Is there an epidemic of people eating crab legs?
It's a political tradition.
I don't know five people who eat crab legs on a regular basis.
But you had that – Arthur had a great story where he showed – the proportion of people on food stamps buying these things compared to, like, the regular population and then compared to other poor people.
Sure. I mean, it almost goes without saying that it's not true.
It's not true. People,
right.
It almost goes without saying, but it turns out we have some numbers in a survey of thousands of people, including poor people, on and not on food stamps. It turns out the ones who get benefits had eaten less crabs. It was just 3% had any crabs.
They had not.
It's like 4% for everybody else.
So stupid.
But they're not allowed to buy cans of tuna? Tuna swept under this ban?
There have been proposals to restrict food stamp food choices in three states, and now in Congress we have one.
Uh-huh.
And it was Missouri. At first they said just no seafood and no steak, any seafood. And in,
that's crazy.
In Wisconsin, they proposed no shellfish. And that's actually, that was approved by the lower chamber of the Wisconsin State Assembly. So,
do you think that the lawmakers here ever, like, take a minute to be like, what am I doing? What, this is so, I'm a fucking idiot. Look at what I've devoted my life to doing. You can't eat clams. Like, that's my fucking legislative, like, legacy. John Mahoney, Missouri state representative, he defined himself by keeping poor people from eating oysters.
Yeah,
fucking hero.
No shellfish.
None of these people actually take stock and like reflect and come to the conclusion that they are like gaping douchebags.
Well, what one of them said was
that this would take self awareness.
He said, right. He admitted it's based on real and perceived abuses. You know, admitting it's based on the.
I like that we're doing it on perceived abuses.
It's based on the apocryphal story of the surf and turf food stamp recipient living large. It also banned junk food, so. There's this notion that people on food stamps, and there are 45 million of them in America. It's a huge program. The only safety net program that you have to use in front of your fellow Americans with a government debit card at the store. But there's this idea that they go from gorging on steak and lobster and then drink buckets of soda and eat cookies and chips. And so the Wisconsin legislation bans all of that. The bill in Congress that came out in the last week doesn't target shellfish or steak.
Oh, well, how nice of
it. It targets the junk food, but it does it in an interesting way. There's another federal program that's smaller than food stamps, serves about 8 million people. It's a program for pregnant women.
WIC.
WIC, yeah.
Yeah, the Women and Infants and Children program. It's you're pregnant or you're nursing or you have a little kid, and this program you get a voucher, and some states it's still paper, and you can only buy like Enfamil and broccoli with it. And so instead of trying to figure out what would be a good thing for people on food stamps to eat, we're just going to take the standard from WIC and change food stamps so that's WIC. So it's a lazy piece of legislation.
You add vodka to Enfamil and broccoli, that's an interesting cocktail.
So that was a proposal. And sponsors of it are members of the committee that oversees this program. And you go back and forth as a reporter being, am I going to write about this bill that's obviously kind of performance art, very theoretical, and give it more attention than it deserves? Or is Republican leadership going to up and fold it into some other thing that's going to pass in the dead of night? Because that's how we got a ban on felons from receiving food stamps. That's in federal law. No
which
debate.
Is, which is just totally smart, because like what you want is for hardened felons to be starving.
Yeah. So I wondered.
That'll show him.
So I did the story. I did the story. I had my existential self doubt, but I went ahead and that's what's going on. Republicans who are more thoughtfully reviewing the program this week actually had a hearing, and they had a former food stamp recipient testify, who basically just said it's a terrific program. And they're like, we thank you for your testimony. And two other guys on the committee were like, what about the food stamp surfer? The guy who Fox News said.
The guy you cherry-picked.
Yeah.
The gaping asshole who's ruining it for everybody.
Yeah, basically. I mean, he looms large over this whole debate. The whole idea, again, that because it's a government program that helps poor people, they don't use it well, really has saturated
How about we pass a law just restricting food stamps from people who go on TV bragging about how they're abusing the system? Problem solved. Like, I'm like, shoop, shoop, shoop with my hands. Problem solved. Like, if you're seeking publicity because you, like, abused your government assistance, no more. Problem solved. Everyone else can continue.
The program only exists because in the early decades of the 20th century, farmers were growing more crops than they could possibly sell. So the government was just buying it from them to help them out. And then they're like, hey, we have all this surplus commodity. Maybe we could give it to poor, hungry people. And then that's where the program came from. It's basically was welfare for farmers first. And then we sort of stumbled into this program that is income support, but instead of just giving people money, it has to be for food. And now we're really grappling with the fact that there's all kinds of food in the modern American grocery store, and you know, some of it is less healthy than others, and we're becoming a more health conscious country, and this is how the debate is playing out over healthy eating.
Why not just incentivize,
by controlling poor people?
Why not just instead of like doing degrading stuff that like dictates to people what they can buy, just like incentivize healthier choices?
That's a great idea. They could do that, but they're not
doing
that.
That would be crazy to do that.
No, that would be really easy. You know, no, that's not happening.
We're talking about people for whom making healthy choices is something they do like maybe twice a year.
Right.
So some of the people who are having this debate are also taking up a debate as to whether they deserve a raise. Steny Hoyer, who's the minority whip in the Senate, in the House, not in the Senate, says that people in Congress deserve a raise. Right now they get paid, I think, $187,000. No, $174,000 a year, which sounds great to me. Sounds pretty awesome.
I could fuck with that.
The only legislature in the world that pays itself three times the median household income of the country it represents.
Yeah. So they need a raise. And so the argument for giving Congress a raise is that if they don't, only the wealthiest people will want to serve in Congress. And I'm like, nah. I mean, if I'm making $50,000 and I get a congressional seat, then I'm suddenly making $124,000 more.
We already have only the wealthiest people.
Yeah, exactly.
That's now, like from that has to do with campaign finance. And like all these other things.
I'll be totally fair about this. Two of the loudest voices for this are Steny Hoyer, who I just mentioned, and Alcee Hastings, neither of whom rank among the wealthiest members of Congress. There are apparently members of Congress who just sort of get by. And it's a fact that in this sort of modern era, Congress critters are expected to have a domicile in Washington, D.C. or thereabouts.
Oh, give me a break.
And a home back in their district.
This is very generous of you to make.
I'm straining myself to be generous. Okay, I'm straining myself.
On $174,000, yeah, you can afford two domiciles.
That's true.
Especially if one of them's not in Washington.
And I'll be honest with you. The whole, like, you got to go home to your district stuff never washed with me. I'm just like, nah, you're a fucking D.C. politician. You stay here.
The reason their salaries
are high.
You
got a mess of fucking politicos back in your home district that can report to you what the fuck you need.
They have high salaries because this was a reform to put a stop to their habit of making paid speeches to moneyed interests who would influence legislation.
Did that stop?
They haven't.
That never happens anymore.
No, yeah. You cannot be go make a paid speech if you're a member of Congress. But you know they haven't had a raise since 2009 when the Tea Party came around. But really, neither has America.
No shit.
So they won't. They won't get one, and that's fine. Good for you. Bye.
Arthur's over it.
There are a lot of people right now. I think this is hilarious. There are a lot of people who actually serve in Congress and live in their offices, like Shaheen Nasirapour, Huffington Post economic reporter.
This is the grandest of standing.
Of course it is.
I live in my office. I'm a member of Congress. My office has a gym, a pool, people clean it for me.
Right,
I got
there's
a bathroom
cafeteria.
And a microwave. Like, it's a really...
It's protected 24/7 by armed guards.
You have to see
renovated
the Capitol complex. Yeah. It's probably the most gorgeous, wonderful office in the world.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, it's pretty nice, but I think in like some... You know, kleptocracies like in Russia, everything's like gold. But yeah, our place is pretty.
It is. There's lots of gold stuff.
Yeah,
in
you're right.
In the capital proper, sure.
That's true.
The satellite legislative offices around there are not as nice, but they're still pretty nice.
Yeah. So I think it's Joaquin Castro, Representative Joaquin Castro, suggested that Congress be declared a public housing project.
To his brother.
Yeah.
His brother, who's that secretary.
Yeah, who's HUD secretary. I'd love to see that happen. Because they are claiming a huge tax-free benefit by living in their office.
Yeah.
And they're passing it off as if it's like a fucking hardship. You know, like like they have cots up there. Like they're a MASH unit or something. You know, like they can't afford a nice bed. It's crazy to me. But yeah, it is like some serious grandstanding. Why do people buy that? Oh, my congressman, he lives real. sleeps in his office?
That's a good question.
I'm glad I asked it then.
I thought
it was okay, but if you say it's good, why do you think people buy that?
I just don't think people realize how nice it is as an office. I personally would rather have my own place.
Yeah,
in a sense, it is nicer to have your own place, but it's not like sleeping in any office that you've ever seen.
Right.
And so people imagine that it's like where I work. No. No, it's not.
I just wonder, like, the rationale, like, oh, if you give people a raise, more people who aren't millionaires or billionaires or whatever will want to serve. It's like people don't want to serve in Congress because it's awful.
Right.
Like, this isn't going
to
make
that, you'd have to give them a pretty big raise.
Yeah. Let me tell you something. If you were a millionaire or a billionaire and you're like, I think I'll run for Congress, I'd be like, dude, you need to have your fucking head examined.
Well,
like Tom Steyer, the billionaire environmentalist donor who
thought about running for Senate.
Yeah, and I was like, is he fucking nuts? He can buy a senator. He can buy a bunch of Congress people. He can buy like a whole section of a state legislature.
Yeah.
That's much better than actually running for Congress.
Here's why I find it galling for members of the U.S. Congress to ask for better compensation. There's the annual salary, which is three times the U.S. median household income. Just leave that aside.
Okay. We'll leave $174,000 aside.
That's part of your compensation.
Hold on. I'm moving this $174,000 to a big space in the room so we can call it aside.
You can you serve for 5 years. Your pension kicks in. You get a pension for life.
Yep.
The longer you serve, the bigger it is. But beyond even that and the perks, you know, the physical environment that you live in, that's
you can frank the shit out of some envelopes, son.
Yeah, you can send all the mail you want.
Yeah.
who doesn't get a thrill up their leg from the privilege of the frank?
Sending mad postcards up in his piece.
Here's why it's galling. If you make it to Washington, you're set for life.
Yeah, basically.
No matter what happens, even if you go to jail, you're a former U.S. congressman or senator. And you can trade on that till you die. You're set for life.
The paid speeches you're not allowed to give while you're...
You can make the paid speeches as soon as you're done. Even the feeble restrictions on becoming a lobbyist that do exist are so easy to get around that you can do it.
Yeah.
Tom Daschle did it.
Yeah.
It's no problem. So you're set for life. So you should just be cognizant of that and not ask for more money. Why they would even ask for money... It's a politically toxic thing, and I don't really even understand why Cindy Hoyer would do that. But here we have laid out the reasons we think that he is incorrect.
There you go. Right now, when Congress critters leave and then come back to D.C. as lobbyists, there's, as you said, all kinds of new laws that kind of shield them from having to disclose themselves as lobbyists. They do lobbying, but they call themselves other names.
Advisors.
If you're in Washington, you can go on Wall Street and work for a private equity
company. Get
Eric Cantor.
They get furious with you. They get furious with you when you call them lobbyists.
Right, because I'm not a lobbyist according to this bizarre legal definition in which the only people who are lobbyists who make two lobbying contacts in the course of the year and do a majority of their work.
Do you remember Evan Bayh, Indiana senator?
Yes.
And, like, soulless suck pump?
That was mean.
I'm a mean person. He's not a good person, so I don't care. So he's got, like, two lobbying jobs after leaving Congress. I wrote an article about how he had two lobbying jobs, and his like some spokesperson, because he wouldn't even confront me himself because he's a coward, like called and yelled.
That's how you really feel.
Called and yelled at me and was like, "He's not a lobbyist." I was like, "Come on, you cannot con an honest John. I know that like you're saying that based on these laws that allow him to claim he's not, but like, is he not calling Congress and advising them, or is he literally standing in a field somewhere waiting and hoping that someone will come up and ask him for his fucking advice? The goddamn lobbyist. Get off the phone with me.
Yeah, the broader popular understanding of what a lobbyist is correct. You know, someone who works for a company and tries to influence Congress.
And you get paid, man. That's why a lot of these people are here. I think that, like, even, you know, Eric Cantor, he didn't want to leave Congress when he left Congress. But when he did, he cashed out okay.
Yeah, he's like, all right.
Yeah, he's doing fine. Doing great. You get put – what's amazing about this is that you don't actually have to return. You don't actually go from Congress to, like, a life of productivity. It's not like, well, now I got to roll up my sleeves, you know – do some hard labor, get down in it, get calluses on my hands again.
That's what George W. Bush did.
Yeah, he painted.
He cleared some brush.
He cleared a lot of brush. You don't have to do that. You sit on these sort of like meaningless boards at corporations, foundations, private equity boards. You know, I don't know what the fuck Eric Cantor knows about private equity.
It's a good question,
you know,
honestly.
All what really matters is that he has connections and can like get you into the room with people of power. That's why, and that's easy, cushy job. And, like, I think a lot of people, you know, I'm sorry, Congress, that you have to live so hard on at your swank office where everything is handed to you and you're taken care of 24/7, and then you only have $174,000 to spend. But just wait a little bit. You will have plenty of opportunities to sell.
I want to just say one last thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
The offices where lawmakers, you know, work and reside, if you're one of those, it's across the street from the Capitol, all around the Capitol. And if it's a hot day, you don't have to go outside to get to the chamber.
You can go underground.
Not only can you go underground, but there's a little train down there that will take you.
They even have their own little choo-choo.
No metro. No metro card required.
They have their own little train.
And their own elevators.
Well, I mean... Yeah.
Yeah. But the train is better. You're right. I don't know why I brought the
all the Chick-fil-A you could ever want at lunch. That sounds good to me.
Yeah. All of
I
it.
Didn't know there was a Chick-fil-A in there.
No, I just mean they always have Chick-fil-A at their events. That's like a thing.
Oh.
Our producers are telling us that there's a Froyo place in the cafeteria.
Really?
At too.
Yeah.
On the Senate side.
That sounds good.
Yeah. So, you know what? Give other people a raise, you assholes.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for joining us today. Today we had politics reporter Samantha Lachman. You can follow her on Twitter.
@ Sam Lachman.
That's right. SamLachman.
LachMan.
Sam man with a lock in the middle.
I was bullied in elementary school for having man in my first name and my last name.
That is some weird bullying.
I know.
Like that is like some eerily specific. It's like someone sat there and was like, how are we going to make fun of Samantha Lachman? Dude, she's got man in both her names.
They called me man squared when we learned about, what are those things? The little numbers. Above
exponents.
Exponents. When we learned about exponents.
Right. Band men.
Yeah.
And we also had senior reporter Arthur Delaney, who you can follow @ Arthur Delaney HP.
Please do that.
Do that right now. He really wants you to follow him. And you can follow me @ Deceiver, DC. Deiver. It's like the word deceiver, but the first E is gone. Sorry for complicating it. So thanks, guys. Thanks for joining us. And coming up, we are going to round out this episode with a continuation of a conversation we started last week with Foreign Affairs reporters Ali Watkins and Akbar Ahmed. Part 2 of our conversation about Seymour Hersh's controversial claims about the Osama bin Laden raid is up next. Hey there, listener of this podcast. I've got a quick little thing I'd love to chat with you about. Are you a regular So That Happened listener? Well, let us know. Send me an electronic communication with your electronic communicating devices at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Tell us what you think of the show, what we're messing up, and who you'd like to hear more from or more about. Okay, back to the program. Okay, to like peel it back a little bit, all right, let's think about this. So we have an official story about how the bin Laden raid went down, mm-hmm. right? And people know this story, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's, I guess, part of our celebrated history. All right, so Hersh is out. He's like, it didn't go exactly the way the Obama administration is telling you. It went this way instead. So, like, if I'm, like, just an ordinary person, I'm like, okay, but he's still dead, right? He's still dead?
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right, so why do I care about this? So let's try to get it, like, what is really at stake here? to have these two competing ideas of how Osama bin Laden was killed.
Yeah, we had a conversation about this yesterday where we were saying, you know, in the grand scheme of conspiracy theories, this the consequence, it's not like you have a, oh, we actually, like, blew up half of Pakistan, not just Osama bin Laden. You know what I mean? The end result is still the same.
Right.
It's the path of how we got to that end result.
I will say, like, 2 points on this. One is, I think your point on ordinary Americans not caring that much matters a lot. And, like, just really quickly, I'd love to share my perspective as a Pakistani.
Yeah, definitely.
Among Americans when the OBL raid happened, right? I was at university, and I remember people being around televisions being like, America, America. And I felt so... in that moment, like, alienated and almost afraid to be a Pakistani on campus, which is a different issue.
Right.
The point being, that was a moment of jubilation, and as you're saying, it's stuck in a national memory. It's not going away. So even if Seymour Hersh now says, Osama wasn't that important to Al-Qaeda, or, like, the SEALs got Osama through working with the Pakistanis, Americans don't care. Americans think, Osama, evil, we were told that. He killed 3,000 people on 9/11. We want him gone. So I think that's an important point. Like, people don't really care.
Yeah, it doesn't change the symbolism of that moment.
Right. The second point I'd make is where it does matter and the stakes are really high is with Pakistani intelligence. And this is, like, this affects the U.S. relationship with them. Seymour Hersh claims that Pakistani intelligence knew where Osama was, hid him for 5 years, kept him in prison, and then sort of, in Hersh's telling, this is what happened. The Americans found out he was there through a walk-in. Went to the Pakistanis, were like, you assholes. And the Pakistanis said, oops, sorry, here you go. Which, like, that's not how relationships work, especially not with the Pakistanis. And if this were to be proven true, like, the Pakistanis are critical to America. Now, Ali and I just did a piece in March on, once again, the White House is cozying up to the Pakistani army and the ISI like never before.
Right.
Because they're moving out of Afghanistan. Who is going to be their patron in Afghanistan? It's going to have to be Islamabad. It's not going to be, like, Iran. Right?
Right. No, of course not. Yeah.
So who is going to do that for them? And if this were to be proven true, the big allegation is the Pakistanis are even shadier than previously acknowledged. And that would be crazy. I don't think American policymakers would be as willing to trust the ISI and the Pakistani army if they knew the army had Osama for 5 years and didn't tell them.
Right.
And the second thing that's at stake there is also with the regional ally. Hersh makes the claim that Saudi funded, like, knew about Osama's presence, funded it, and managed it, which is a very strange claim to make. And again, says, do you want to be friends with these people if that's true? So this is just saying, if that were true, the U.S. relationships with Pakistan and Saudi would be in major jeopardy.
Hersh also claims that the cache of intelligence materials that were carted off from the raid, it's a complete fabrication.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any truth to that? Like,
I think his claim is more that it was, like, gotten in other places and then they pretended it was from.
But one thing Max Fisher does point out, and I will give him this, is that he points out that al-Zawahiri, like, quoted from that material before we knew of its existence.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like a really odd claim, super contradictory, because, you know, tons of stories have been written about that intelligence that was carted off from that, including stories about how toward the end, bin Laden was concerned that al-Qaeda had sort of, like, lost the hearts and minds of the people that al-Qaeda was ostensibly supporting. And they become known for just simply ruining the lives of Muslim people.
Right.
And that, you know, to put it glibly, it's a shitty and glib way to put it, al-Qaeda's branding had suffered.
Right.
Essentially, yeah.
Which is, like, a kind of fucked up thing to say. Yeah, exactly.
Wait, there is an
al-Qaeda brand? Okay. But there was a lot of reporting done off that material, and now that's a fabrication as well?
I don't think Hersh says it's a fabrication. I think Fisher got the nuance wrong there.
Okay.
Hersh's claim, to my understanding, is these were real files and documents, like Zawahiri quoted from them. They are valid. His claim is, in his elaborate story of, like, this was an invented event to support Obama's reelection. Like, we have to remember, that's what he says it's about. He says this was an invented event. The Americans got that documentation elsewhere and pretended it was from the Osama bin Laden raid. So they sort of had it from whatever other raids they'd been doing. And they were like, look at this big win. Also, here is another big win. Like, gilding the lily, as it were.
Okay, fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
Was that your understanding?
Yeah, essentially. The information was always there. It was just where we got it.
So there's an article in Foreign Policy from Hussein Haqqani, who is at the time of the raid, he was Islamabad's ambassador to Washington. And he is crazy skeptical of this thing. He says that a lot of the Hirsch's allegations border on fantasy. He says that if the ISI hadn't been holding on to Bin Laden for all this time, there's no way they would have cooperated with the U.S. for some kind of like raid on this without like a serious ironclad quid pro quo. They would have demanded glory from cooperation. They would have asked you to talk about gilding Lily. The ISA would have asked for their Lily to get crazy gilded after this. He does say that when he was interviewed in the wake of the raid, that Connie felt that someone was protecting Bin Laden.
I give credence
to... But he insists it wasn't the ISI or the Pakistani government.
I do give a little bit of credence, not a ton, to Ambassador Haqqani. Ambassador Haqqani is a person who lives in Washington now and cannot return to Pakistan.
Right.
Because he was removed from his post as ambassador. The army hates him.
Pushed out by the generals in Hirsch's story.
And now he's turning around. So that's interesting, because the army and the ISI hate Haqqani and they hate his wife, who is a parliamentarian, Farhanaz Isfahani. So for him to turn around and say this is interesting... I think his point that someone had to know is important. And that goes back to, like, this woman, Carlotta Gall, who was a New York Times correspondent. She also last year wrote, the ISI knew. So that's sort of been around. I mean, the ISI could not have not known. Like, they're good at their jobs. They're horrible, and they are, like, exploitative, but they are good at what they do.
Right, right.
I think Ambassador Haqqani's takedown of this, though, is a little... It's not based on reporting. And that to me is like, this is a lot of people spouting off. It's based on, I was there, but you were ambassador for a civilian government that did not have good ties with the military at the time.
Right.
If the military was running stuff, they were not like calling Haqqani and be like, hey, Hussein, just keeping you in the loop, FYI, we got $25 million. Because they're not going to give Ambassador Haqqani a cent of those $25 million. So I think it's a good point. It's well argued, but he might not have been in the know at the time. As much as he claims.
I think the biggest thing, and from the Haqqani story too, that we're kind of getting in this aftermath of the Hirsch story is that someone somewhere in ISI knew or related somehow to ISI knew, you know, how valuable the information was that got to the U.S. through that potential avenue still is yet to be seen, given editors' notes and whatnot. But I think... you know, looking off of all of these stories, it's like that seems to be the one consistency.
Right.
You know, it's like nobody really knows the specifics of it, but there was some asset somewhere that appears to – which also doesn't totally dilute the Obama administration narrative if that part is true. Because, right. You know, if hypothetically there was this intelligence asset from Pakistan that sold this secret to the CIA, it would make sense for the Obama administration to hide that fact.
Right.
Sure, yeah.
Obviously, they're not going to be like, hey, by the way, this guy over here, just for the record, ISI was this one.
This dude.
Exactly. So that is an interesting twist in this whole narrative that honestly only complicates an incredibly complicated story further.
I think the thing that Ambassador Haqqani raises that is really good with that question is, someone somewhere knew. And now the really big question people have to find out is, why did the Pakistanis do this? If they knew and they sheltered him. And there's a lot of theories around that and not a lot of good reporting.
Right.
One instance is the colleague I mentioned who got into trouble with the ISI. Dexter Filkins in The New Yorker wrote a profile of him in 2011. And his name was Salim Shahzad. What Salim was researching was ties between Al-Qaeda and the Pakistani army. And 2 weeks after the Osama bin Laden raid, or like 3 weeks, the biggest naval base in Pakistan got infiltrated, attacked by Al-Qaeda. It's in my hometown. They destroyed tons of equipment, killed scores of military people. And what Dexter Filkins in New Yorker says is, it appears that the army is scared of Al-Qaeda sympathizers in its own ranks. This is a really overlooked point. So it might not even be cash. It might be ideological. There might be ISI officers who are like, we believe in Osama. We will keep him because he is... to some extent, not just strategically important, like our spiritual whatever leader. And that's scary. That is, in fact, one of the scariest things. Because Ambassador Haqqani asks, why would the Pakistanis keep him? Why would they not tell the U.S.? that might be a reason because
– So sort of like a Kim Philby situation in the ISI.
I'm not familiar.
Oh, he's Kim Philby is the British spy, MI6, who was a Soviet double agent for decades and actually was liaison in the 50s with American intelligence and at the Soviet Union's behest, he disrupted a ton of British intelligence operations throughout Europe.
I think people use that comparison a couple times when talking about this story, like that just whole twisting spy for a spy thing.
Yeah, but you know, I think there have been implications that the ISI has been infiltrated by Al-Qaeda like probably since, you know,
forever.
Yeah, forever. You know, at least, you know, I was reading about this certainly in the wake of the September 11th attacks and straight on up, and it's always to me been like a serious complicating factor in anything the United States does with Pakistan, but we still have this critical linchpin relationship with Pakistan, and it obviously has to do with the fact that they're a nuclear power, has the fact that there's like a lot of like kind of like tea cooling that needs to happen between Pakistan and India. There's the hope, like you said, of playing some kind of like role in the void we leave in Afghanistan, and so as troublesome as we have it,
right.
And they have it with us too. Mm-hmm. We're kind of like locked in this like kind of like tango with one another. Right. How do we keep on dancing after this story?
Yeah, it's an incredibly complicated relationship, and we did a lot of kind of backgrounding and sourcing on this when we were working on sort of our Pakistan stories. You know, some of my conversations on the U.S. intelligence side of it, again, being skeptical of your sources, but kind of listening to what they perceive of that relationship, which is very different from what the ISI perceives of the U.S. relationship, is kind of – I mean, the U.S. is the first to maybe not officially, but, you know, think bad things about the ISI. They're also more than willing to work with them when it's beneficial for the U.S. You know, there's been evidence of cooperation between the CIA and ISI on drone strikes. We've seen documentation of that back in 2013. One of the perceptions that I've kind of heard is that, you know, the U.S. and ISI or CIA, ISI, Intel, ISI, whatever you want to say, more than willing to work together. The kind of gentleman's agreement is that Pakistan can always deny it, and Pakistan can always say, look at all this terrible shit the U.S. is doing. And then behind the back door, they're like, yeah, sure, you can pull that drone trigger. We're just going to look this way. You know, there's a kind of weird mutual understanding to an extent, I think. At least that's the perception from the U.S. side.
And this is one of the strongest parts of Seymour Hersh's piece, is when he talks about the relationship with the ISI, where he says what the ISI has to gain from the U.S. is money, and it's not money. I think people misunderstand this because U.S. military aid to Pakistan has kind of yo-yoed and gone down. Covert aid, as Ali knows all too well, doesn't go on any books. Like, that's just there.
Right,
that's just like coffers of money that's given to the ISI. No one knows. So when we're like, the U.S. Pakistan relationship has really been struggling. Meanwhile, like, the spigot...
Money's going out the door.
We're dropping money bags like on random corners. Right.
Charlie Wilson style.
Right. It's very Charlie. And that's the other thing from the Pakistani side. They're like, you guys came and you screwed us over. Like, we were not a basket case before Charlie Wilson came and was like, maybe your country could only serve as a purpose to push the Soviets out of Afghanistan. Maybe that's what your country is. And the Pakistanis were like, okay, do you have a lot of money? And he was like, yeah. So they did it. And the Pakistanis really blame the U.S. for that to date, right? They say the reason we have radical Islamic extremism is the 1980s.
Right.
It is the U.S. creating the Taliban Mujahideen in our backyard and in parts of our country that were ungoverned. So I think how does that relationship continue now? Like, they know they need the U.S., but they feel very, very burned by the U.S. over time. And I'm not justifying that. I'm just saying that's how they feel. Like, they feel like the U.S. has demonized them, villainized them, said the ISI is evil, set homeland there. Like, we don't like these things. Zero Dark 30. Like, literally had people in Pakistan speaking Arabic. Do you even know who we are? Like, it's rough. So from that point of view, the Pakistanis feel burned by the U.S. And no one likes, especially not when you are the lone Islamic nuke. And you think you're really powerful. The Pakistanis are pretty, I mean, they're like the fifth biggest army in the world or something. They don't think of themselves as anyone's sidekick, right? And if the U.S. treats them that way, they're not going to react well. Mm-hmm. So that's why it does become inherently transactional, because I think it has a respect deficit.
Yeah. I don't know that this is necessarily a nuclear bomb on the relationship. I think the relationship has just always been incredibly complicated and takes twists and turns
right.
every time something happens. And this is just another twist. And nobody knows the truth in it, which is going to make it that much
more. So this is kind of like Real Housewives of Orange County if everyone had and massive intelligence apparatuses.
Yeah, essentially.
All right. Well, we're all just guys living in pre-war apartments that will never be post-war apartments. Let me go back and say we talked about this for 2 days, 2 podcasts, and we'll keep coming back to it. And yeah. I want to thank you guys for being here. And you guys can follow Allie Watkins on Twitter at @AliWatkins.
Yep.
And your Twitter account, I do not know.
It's Akbar.
Offhand. I mean, I follow you.
So it's AKBAR. I feel like I'm at Starbucks. AKBARSAHMED.
There you go.
Yeah.
Ali Akbar.
Also, just a quick side note, middle name.
It's a really good team.
It's nice because whenever we write stories on the region, we'll always get, they're like, oh, Ali Akbar, you're reporting to, I can't tell you how many emails I've gotten that say, thanks for your article, Mr. Watkins. And I'm like, does Watkins sound like a name that
Ali
would,
praise.
Oh, well.
Praise be to Allah.
All right, well, inshallah, we'll do have a discussion again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced and edited by Ibrahim Balki, with technical direction from Brad Shannon and assistance from Christine Canetta and Adriana Usero. I'm Jason Linkins. This week, we were joined by HuffPost reporters Akbar Ahmed, Arthur Delaney, Sam Lockman, and Ali Watkins. So That Happened is available on iTunes. Please check us out on the iTunes store for the Huffington Post's whole family of podcasts. Subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, please send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. As always, thanks for listening, and we miss you already.